by their tendency to occupy a vulnerable position within the narrative. In my work, animals seem to either be dead, dying, or in fear of their inevitable death. And this fear is always at the hands of man, the unknown destructive force that invades and violates their environment. I victimise these animals by default, and what I'm exploring in this paper is not only why this happens, but if it is always true to say that in animal narratives, animals become victims. In stories with animals, it seems there is no such thing as a happy ending. And in most narratives, the primary objective is survival, to stay alive for as long as conceivably possible. When I write, I tend to anthropomorphise animals, and they seem to possess both human and non-human qualities. This is perhaps influenced by my identity as a British writer. As Margaret Atwood writes in her text Survival, a thematic guide to Canadian literature, it's true that stories ostensibly about animals appear in British literature, but the animals in them are really, like the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland, Englishmen in furry zippered suits, often with a layer of human clothing added on top. But this is not what I am trying to achieve. As I continue to develop my practice, I'm hoping to move away from this idea that as a British writer, my work depicts social commentary in the form of a rabbit. I want my creative voice to speak more of the struggle between the human and non-human, and of the characteristics of the predator-prey binaries which this paper takes as its focus. So as to distance myself from what I've come to view as the traditional British animal story, I've chosen to focus on texts which either subvert or disregard the process of anthropomorphism entirely. Further to this, I have singled out Canadian and South African writers who seem to have a deeper and more poignant connection to the animals that appear in their work. In Britain, we understand our relationship to the wild through the impact of our existence on animals such as badgers and foxes, whereas in Canada, the badgers are moose, and in South Africa, the foxes are lions. But this is not to say that our relationship with animals is any less significant. Our relationship is fraught with the same tensions and the same defining of boundaries. However, this does raise questions on how we classify certain species as being potentially wilder than others. And in my research, I'm exploring how this might influence how we talk and write about such species. So with this in mind, I've chosen to focus on Margaret Atwood's Mad Adam and Lauren Butte's Zoo City. These texts are as similar as they are different, and though perhaps not strictly classified as animal narratives, they represent a way of thinking towards animals and towards the future of our relationship with them, which has prompted me to consider the position of animals as victims within my own writing. Atwood's Mad Adam tells of a dystopian future in which relationships between humans and animals take on a distinct predator-prey opposition within the narrative. As the third instalment in the Mad Adam trilogy, the text offers up a potential resolution to the conflict set up by its predecessors. To give some context, the events leading up to Mad Adam depict a waterless flood, an outbreak of a fatal contagion developed by the mad scientist Craik. There are few survivors, and those who made it through were presumably in isolation at the time of the outbreak. There are animals here too, though not animals in the traditional sense. They are transgenic species, released or otherwise escaped from various compound laboratories. Left unchecked, their numbers have multiplied, and they have now become an integral part of the post-apocalyptic landscape they inhabit. There are wolvogs, liobams, racunks, and mohairs, to name a few of the hybrids. There are even glowing green rabbits, which were no doubt introduced by Atwood as a subtle reference to the bioartist Eduardo Kac. And for those of you not familiar with Kac's work, he was responsible for the creation of the GFP bunny, a rabbit spliced with green fluorescent protein back in 2000. So to have such rabbits appear in abundance throughout this trilogy puts forward the suggestion that this text takes place in a not-so-distant future. But of all the species created by Atwood, there are two which stand apart from the rest, the pigoons and the krakers. Nicknamed pigoons for their balloon-like appearance, these giant pigs are spliced with human cell tissues. When first introduced in Oryx and Craig, Atwood described the process of growing an assortment of foolproof human tissue organs in a transgenic knockout pig host, organs that would transplant smoothly and avoid rejection. Such a host animal could be reaped of its extra kidneys. It could keep on living and grow more organs. By the time of Mad Adam, the pigs have been successfully spliced with human neocortex tissue, presumably making them more intelligent and resourceful, more human in their customs and thought processes. all the transgenic species in the text, the pygoons prove to be the most problematic. Due to their composition, they occupy the space between human and non-human, and so do not fall easily into the victim category. Then there are the Krakers, perhaps best described as the non-human humans in the text, and the only species in the trilogy that demands a vulnerable position. Initially, they are greeted with some trepidation by the remaining humans. They are both feared and pitied for their differences in equal measure. Atwood describes the Krakers as the gentle humanoid species, bioengineered by the brilliant Krake. Free from sexual jealousy, greed, clothing, and the need for insect repellent and animal protein. All the factors Krake believed had caused not only the misery of the human race, but also the degradation of the planet. They share an affinity with the animals, perhaps attributed to the fact that they themselves are transgenic. Later in the text, the Krakers mediate between the pygoons and the survivors. As the only ones capable of conversing with the animals, the Krakers negotiate a truce. They unite the pygoons and the survivors against the common evil, a second, more destructive group of survivors, referred to as the painballers. These men are subhuman, described in the text as dehumanized prisoners. It's interesting to note at this point that they are described in this predatory position, but are not directly referenced as being in any way animalistic. In its entirety, Mad Adam feels like a constant negotiation between the animals and the humans. Neither is sure of the other's intent. There is a moment quite early on in the text which I feel perfectly captures the ambivalence of the animal-human relationships. One of the main protagonists, Toby, is dreaming as she sleeps in the temporary safe house the humans have built. Inside this dream, she's dreaming of animals. One is a pig, though six-legged. Another is cat-like, with compound eyes like a fly. There's a bear as well, but it has hooves. These animals are neither hostile nor friendly. In keeping with the dystopian theme, Lauren Bukes's Zoo City depicts a futuristic Johannesburg. Unlike Mad Adam, the animals which feature in this text are more realistic in their composition, so far as they exist as identifiable species. Echoing Philip Pullman's Northern Lights, Bukes' animals appear as bonded spirits, in the same way that Pullman's demons are attached to one person. Each animal brings with them a special talent. For the text's main protagonist, Zinzi, the talent brought to her by her sloth is the ability to find lost things. Of this, Zinzi describes, "The problem with my particular gift is that everybody's lost something. Stepping out in public is like walking into a tangle of cat's cradles. On some people, the lost strings are cobwebs. On others, it's like they're dragging steel cables. Finding something is all about figuring out which string to tug on." The animals appear only after the person they are bound to commits a crime, or otherwise experiences a significant amount of guilt or liability. The animals themselves seem to appear as a physical manifestation of sin. These people are frequently referred to throughout the novel as zoos, or the animals, suggesting they are in some way marked and thus persecuted by society. They are to some extent victimised, leading half-lives shared with their animal companions. Relationships between humans and animals become more complex in Zoo City. The animals can experience pain and suffering inflicted on their human, but that experience cannot be reciprocated. Yet there remains an emotional bond between the two, and the separation of a zoo from their animal serves as a form of torture in the Johannesburg prison system. Violence against animals is far more prevalent in this text. There are scenes of mutilation and animal sacrifice, and a particularly graphic scene towards the novel's conclusion involving a rabbit. Bukes describes a scene in which an animal woman has repeatedly stabbed herself, writing, "Her sunshine yellow satin robe is drenched in blood like bad tie-dye. There is a shivering bundle wrapped in a towel under the lounger." He reaches underneath the lounger and hauls up the trembling rabbit by its ears. It closes its eyes in terror, nose twitching frantically. As victims, these animals exist to be persecuted. There is no doubt in my mind that their very inclusion in Atwood and Bukes demands such a reading. But how do they become victims? To simply say that they are non-human and therefore victims does not serve as a satisfying justification of their purpose in the narrative. In Atwood, transgenic species represent animals for the purposes of humans. The victimization happens in the moment that animal becomes altered. Atwood depicts a destructive future in Mad Adam, best expressed through the violation of these vulnerable creatures. This is not a story in which we follow the animals. This is a story in which we follow the downfall of humanity as categorised by their impact on the animals which feature in the text. Victimisation is a consequence and not something which is inherent to each non-human species. They are victims only because they are present in a narrative which demands their role as victim. In Buttes, animals place a marker on the humans they are bound to. They are victims, but only so long as they exist alongside a persecuted human. They are neither predator nor prey, but their presence in the novel elicits violence against both themselves and the humans they are connected to. They are not self-victimising, but their victimisation comes as a direct result of human suffering. There are moments within the text where an animal's human inflicts pain upon themselves, thus victimising their own animal, because the animal must endure that pain. The novel then becomes about the human capacity for self-harm, in addition to the human capacity to victimise or harm animals. So this leads me to consider victimisation within my own work, and this happens in the moments at which the animal becomes like a human. Anthropomorphism demands human qualities, and this process strips the animal of their animality. The animal body becomes a vessel for metaphor, for exploring elements of humanity that are otherwise closed off to interpretation. Up until now, my work has been responsible for exploring the darker elements of my own humanity, as projected onto animals. But having now read Atwood and Buttes, I feel I can confidently move away from this idea that animals are victims by default. Perhaps the best way to sum up my intentions is with a quote from, I can never pronounce his name, Jane Coetzee, text The Lives of Animals, of Animal Life and Death, he writes, "To animals, death is continuous with life. It is only among certain very imaginative human beings that one encounters a horror of dying so acute that they then project it onto other beings, including animals. Animals live, and then they die. That is all." So as a practice-based researcher, I disseminate my critical ideas on animals through reflective creative practice. So I'm now going to present a piece of writing in which I interrogate the themes of victimisation, alluding to different ways of classifying victims within the same narrative. So I hope you find this interesting and that it might prompt you to consider the complexities of the relationships between predator, prey and victim. They stood in tweed lines, rolling scotch over their tongues into throaty laughs. Spaniels or pointers twitched around Buttes, snapping at the titbits pushed into their mouths to quiet them. They had gathered at the edge of the lock, watching the tepid morning as it spread out over the heather. Each man stood with a different rifle, stroking fingers over the chambers to the stock, marvelling at the calibres. Some eagerly eyed the cusp of the hill, as others adjusted straps and camouflaged waterproofs. One man drew a thick, inked thumb across the bridge of his nose. They ascended the hill, a cloud of spring green moving over the brow. Each man carved their own path across the limestone. Dogs held taut, worrying the earth beneath their paws. One man lifted a finger to his lips and then laid out flat his hand, signalling the party to level out. As they reached the border, they pressed their bellies into the soil, perceiving it to crawl. First, a slender leg, then a thin nose extended from the fog. Crested lashes mimicked beats above the eyes as they flitted over the landscape. She left indents in the wet grass. A tremor rose through her body, dispelling the beads of sweat from the base of her skull to the nape of her neck. A brittle breath rattled from between her ribs, shaking out into a cough. She coughed again, searching for something invisible. One man bent over the hungry trigger, salivating. He waited for the other men, each tilted a chin in approval. He ground his teeth into the spearmint gum caught between his molars as he trained the gaze. A single shot ricocheted through the space between him and her, cracking into her flank before spinning her off into the creeping fog. He swore under his breath, exasperated by its foolishness. A little to the left, he thought. A little to the left, and it would have been a clean kill. The men surrounding him loosened, shaking off his embarrassment. They regrouped before dispersing, setting the dogs onto the trail of the wounded. For an hour they stalked, drifting through the countryside to put it out of its misery, until the risen sun exposed them. One man retreated to his 4x4, his hands raw but empty. Evening slipped the roads into purple skies as he drove, taking corners with unnecessary speed. The laughter hung in his ears like a stale smoke, lingering long after the last cigar had been put out. Mockery had made this one man into something less, and as though tugged out by the discord, she lurched from a hidden gutter into the road, eyes locked with the brazen headlights. In the fleeting second before impact, he thought he saw her tongue curl around her lips. He crouched over her broken form, feeling the warmth of black blood behind her ear. He could feel the sinew pulse and watch the dome of her eye as it began to swell. He hoisted the body into the boot, collapsing the limbs to fit into the space, and the road before him opened up as he relaxed into his seat. A dilapidated shed stands at the end of his garden. Inside, three large breezes hum, impatient. He lifts the lid of one to reveal her head amongst the ice. He runs a cautious finger over her thin nose, smoothing beneath her swollen eye. He pushes a strand of yellow hair behind her ear. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yes.
Just to go back to Margaret Atwood's work, I've read R.T. Craig, and I've read about half of the Europe as well. So you're talking about the sort of the hybrid human animals, but there's also hybrid animals.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could comment on the distinctions and the differences in what she's trying to evoke in the reader through the portrayal of those sort of two distinct transgender species.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I have really focused onto the animals specifically. But I think in regards to the Quakers, I think she's trying to put them into an animal position. I think there's something about their composition which makes them distinctly more animal than they are human. The fact that they themselves are spliced with animals, and the fact that in the text they just appear as being so vulnerable and victimised themselves. So I think what she's trying to achieve in terms of like larger audience, wouldn't be able to pin it down, but for me I definitely get the feeling she's trying to sort of make us more aware of our relationship, future relationships with animals potentially through the Quakers, if that makes sense.
Just follow that up. I got to the end of that, Adam. I was going to talk about it. I know it's quite hard. But I came away from that feeling really quite up, because I thought she kind of ends it more on this collaboration between the Quakers and the sort of good humans, and the Penguins particularly. And kind of the evil is the purely human paintballs, isn't it, at the end, hiding in the woods. So I took it as a much more positive sense, that it's only by, you know, recognizing the animal in us and all of that, that we will defeat that purely anthropocentric humanistic agenda. Maybe I'm just unduly optimistic.
I've never thought about it in that way, but then again I also left that text feeling really unsatisfied, because it didn't give me a happy ending.
Right.
sometimes that's all you really want. Like you want the characters, like the ones who are in love, you want them to be together. It doesn't happen like that.
Doesn't happen, does it?
Which is why I guess I kind of feel like it's sort of saying we're sort of moving towards this uncertain future. Because there isn't a happy ending offered.
Yeah.
You know, she didn't round it off in a way which said this is finished. It was very much like a continuation.
British tradition, and clearly I think you're right in terms of Beatrix Potter and the kind of early 19th century stuff, but I'm wondering if there's another British tradition you could reclaim as well, which is doing something quite different. I'm thinking of things like Virginia Woolf's Flush, and later, it's a bit different, but William Golding's The Inheritance, because both of those texts are kind of experiments with the perspective of a creature who is experiencing the world in a completely different way to you. So there's a point, Flush is a biography of Elizabeth Barrett Browning's pet spaniel, that she says suddenly, you know, kind of, but the spaniel is experiencing the world through his nose. How do I, as a human being, write that down? I can't understand what he's smelling. And William Goldman, The Inheritors, is telling the story of the kind of the meeting of Neanderthals with Cro-Magnons and the creation of the human, the beginnings of the Homo sapiens, from the perspectives of the Neanderthals who don't have thought or have such kind of basic thought that they can't understand these other humans, these other creatures who are a bit like them, who have ritual. And as a reader, it puts you in a position where you're having to kind of decipher their incomprehension to think, oh, they're building a boat, oh, they're making a fire. And what it's kind of testing is what is possible. And so I'm wondering, rather than worrying about anthropocentrism and anthropomorphism, whether you could actually take it in the other direction and think about the possibility of abandoning hope that you can experience with, but thinking about what it might mean to not know.
Yeah, I mean, that generally kind of sums up a little bit of the kind of things I've tried to write before. I always forget his name. Yeah, his name's gone. But like Ted Hughes with like Motown Diary, that's sort of like from the perspective of animals, especially the sort of darker side of animal life. I've tried that before, but I guess I'm really interested with anthropomorphism because of sort of what it sets out to do, really. And like most of the texts that I've read with anthropomorphism, they tend to be commenting on some form of humanity, you know, and how we sort of conduct ourselves socially. So I do kind of want to see what I can do with that, because I think, especially with Zoo City, there are sort of elements in there in which there's sort of anthropomorphism because of how close the sort of spirit animals are to humans. So, yeah, so I think it's, but yeah, I've written that down.
Any other questions? No? Okay, well, in that case, thank you once again to Catherine, first of all. And we've got a break now for half an hour, so I'm hoping that there's refreshments through in the room over at the back, and then we'll be back in here for the next session at 3:30.